how I identify myself, one, I'm an aunt, I'm a sister, a daughter, and I am a social worker, a radical social worker, someone who's studying about herbs, natural healing, and I feel like all of that is connected to who I am today, an activist. All of that is blended together for me. Mm-hmm. Well, it started in 1998. My very first protest was regarding remedial classes being cut at CUNY, and that was through Jeremy Landis. I went with him, and that was huge for me, being able to participate in that. And then right after that, I got to meet Clam students, and they talked to me about police brutality, and they were handing out flyers about Lumia, and I didn't know about that case, and I hadn't really put together all of what they were saying about police brutality, so I wanted to research about that, and so many people were so upset that I'd even taken a flyer from SPAM students when I was walking through the hallways, and that made me even more curious, more intent to do research and find out about what was being spoken about by the SLAM students. And then I got involved with Luz during the high school organizing campaign work. So we would get up early and start door knocking, and that was great about that. And then I left. I graduated in 99 from Hunter, so I was just really motivated and inspired. And so when I left and I went to SUNY Stony Brook for social work school, I carried all of that with me and met friends there named Jenny, for example, and some other students. And we started organizing together, and that's when I got invited to participate in R2K. And that's where I considered it. It was very deep for me to do that then.
Were you inspired by, like, the focus on police and prisons that we had decided on for R2K? Was that what sort of inspired you, or was it like working with SLAM in particular?
Actually, I'll tell you the story of how it happened. So I was told about it, and especially when I heard the part about direct action, like I'd never done direct action before, and I never ran the risk of arrest in that way. So I went for a long bike ride, and I sat amongst some trees, and I just really considered it. And it just became clear to me that the different issues that were of concern, you know, just police brutality, making a statement about how we wanted our world to be different. And I had a lot of trust in the people that I was working with. That's why I did it. You know, I wanted to be united in that way, and to make a statement together with the people that I trusted and that I'd organized with, to say what we wanted this world to be like. And it was a very empowering feeling, very strong feeling to be alive in that way.
What was your role going to be like on the day of August 1st?
We had two different things. So there was going to be the flying squad, and I was going to be either helping people get freed up when they got pinned down, or I was going to be in the puppet space, when people were going to be constructing their different pieces to be locked down. And so just in having a conversation with the people who are going to be participating in either of those things, it just seemed to make sense for me to be in the puppet space. But I knew that there, you know, there might be even more of a chance for me to get arrested being in that space. It just dawned on me, and I was like, you know, well, I could still do it. And that's what I did. And that's exactly what happened. The puppet space got surrounded, and I was upstairs, and one of my friends said, you know, like, they're around. Like, some people got out just in time. They went to go smoke a cigarette. The smokers survived. one point for the smokers, they were not caught. And then everyone else was still inside, and I was like, oh, my God. And they just surrounded. You could hear the helicopters, and people were talking in codes all the time because everyone was afraid of infiltration or just speaking about infiltration very openly. Like, some people here are police officers, and that just created an interesting vibe in the place. Like, people had affinity groups, and so you knew to trust your affinity group, but you didn't know necessarily about someone else's, so that was strange, but interesting. And people were attempting to make decisions through consensus, and that was the first time I'd participated in anything like quite like that, on that, especially on that scale. So people were using spokes councils and et cetera through their affinity circles. It was just, it was intense. It was definitely a very good experience in participatory democracy. I was in my 20s, so that was really great to just be a part of that. Like, being frustrated by the process of consensus, inspired by it, experiencing the distress that people had that I had, and then also how we overcame that. It's good. Like, we struggled. We definitely all struggled with each other. But as Sandra would say, or Kaidi would say, it was a principled struggle, which was great.
Sandra and Kizembe both described, like, the big meeting inside the puppet house, and, like, you know, people could have, like, gotten away before they got a search warrant, right? And then, like, during all these hours of having a meeting, the police did get a search warrant.
Hmm. That's funny. I don't remember any of that. I just remember everybody screaming. And then once we got settled, on the phone was finished screaming. Like, I was totally upstairs and oblivious. I was, like, not with what was happening. I was in the restroom. And we had to get it together. I felt like everybody was trying to get it together. It's a lot to make those decisions. Like, I don't remember the part about the search warrant, but I remember people being very passionate. And so it's so hard to get everyone who's so passionate or who are very afraid to make clear-headed decisions. And I think that's what took a long time, too. Not just the consensus process, but just that people were really nervous, excited, scared, you know, all those things happening at once. It's hard to make such a clear, quick decision, especially involving so many people. So,
yeah. Totally. And then, because Zembe described, like, being held in the school bus for hours, and I had forgotten about how he passed out and then was taken to the hospital. He said that he was dragged out by his arms and his hair out of the bus. Were you on that bus?
Yes, I was. That was horrible. Before we got pulled out of the puppet warehouse, the puppet space, which is just funny, a funny name, right? Like, people were creating puppets and these pieces for a performance to speak even louder, you know? Just interesting, like, how it all happened there. You know, it just seems like it's just a puppet space. Like, why would we drag that in that way? It's interesting. Anyway, we were talking to the press, I believe. I feel like that happened before we got onto the bus. I think her name was Sarah. But yeah, we were out there. We were trying to negotiate and say our message at the same time. Then we were eventually all just dragged onto the buses, and they put these little plastic ties on ties around our wrists, and they were really tight. And so some people would say, oh, this is too tight, and sometimes the police would adjust them, or sometimes they weren't adjusted. And then I know because they were screaming a lot. I think he was screaming in pain. I could barely remember everything, but I think Sandra and I were sitting close to each other, and then that's when I saw him, like, in the aisle, just passed out, and then, like, they were dragging him off the bus. That's when we saw, everyone went berserk on the bus when that was happening. But there's definitely a moment of, wow, there's nothing we could do about that. like we can't stop them. Our hands are all tied. So that was really, and I was just worried about him bleeding or hurting his head. And they were dragging him off. That was really, that was devastating to see.
Oh, God. Yeah. Yeah, wow. So then from there, you were taken to the roundhouse?
Yeah. We were taken to, I guess the, like the, we did the bookings, I guess.
Uh-huh.
I feel like that's what happened. Like, we were then, we were held in this, in these jail cells first, and we had some kind of, we had codes, like people could say, I think, purple or something like that, if they felt like they couldn't take it anymore and they needed to get out, you know? Because they would let you go if you gave your information, and so we had decided that we would start doing solidarity within for people who also had, who were getting, I think getting charged with higher convictions, so instead of a misdemeanor, a felony, et cetera, so we weren't giving our information, we all were just going to be in jail with each other. There were hundreds of us. And so some people said purple and got out of there because it's just really intense to be there under the fluorescent lights. And, God, they kept giving us Wawa iced tea. I had such an aversion to that stuff. Still do. Still don't like Wawa. Wawa inside of the jail. And that's really what hit me about the prison industrial complex. Like, oh, my goodness, there are all these products that are available, that are part of the system, that are benefiting from the system. So just seeing that was just really mind-blowing, you know?
I know, like, there's, like, private phone companies in, like, these big prisons that charge a ton of money for people to call their families, right?
That, I mean, I didn't even, I was just blown away by the prisons themselves and how, for example, I mean, this is rushing it a little, but once we were inside of the jail, like, there are different hair products for black women. It just felt like, oh, Johnson & Johnson, like, they're getting paid off of this, too. You know, just looking at how quantities of these materials are, like, it takes money, it takes investment from these different businesses to keep the businesses also going. Like, it's a relationship. So that's when,
wow,
I first saw it. Like, saw it with my own eyes. So that was my first education, really, I think, about the prison industrial complex.
Is there anything, like, that you, that stands out in your memory about, like, some of the meetings of the activists, like, inside of the roundhouse?
I think that's when we had more consensus and more conversations, and it was more of the same to me. And it was just intense. It was just, I mean, I think in that part, I could just remember what was happening for me, just, like, feeling, like, really, like, I just needed to sleep. Like, I just felt really kind of depleted, you know? And there's just no rest, like, no way to rest, like, with fluorescent lights, you know? And, like, this bread with crazy oil, cheese, and, like, the Wawa. And I was like, get me out of here. We're there for, it just felt like for hours and hours. But I felt, I just remember the process that we said, like, we weren't going to give our names, or we weren't going to give our information, and that was just intense, you know, just to say, well, this is where I'm staying, even though I don't want to be here, you know? But it was something that I chose to do, but at the same time, I just didn't like it. Didn't want to be there, and then also at the same time, wanted to, so. Yeah, that's what I remember.
Wow.
And there were different arguments and, like, all that stuff was happening at the same time. People trying to make decisions with each other. I remember at that moment also, that was my first experience also, like, understanding or just getting a glimpse of the different types of discrimination that happened within the system, within the prison system also. So, for example, queer folks, like genderqueer folks in particular, were treated differently. So this one person who, like, was brought over to the female section was just really upset because it was really deep, like, identified not as male, not as female, but you know, so it's like, where is someone put in that position, like, because of the like the segregation within the prison system also. So, you know, it's just, that was really intense too. And so some people were saying, oh, like, how did you get here? Like, aren't you a guy, or are you a woman, you know? And I remember the person saying, you know, like, no, I'm neither. I'm none of these. And it was just like, at that point, there wasn't really, at that point, like, a real conversation or dialogue that people were a part of, you know, in terms of just understanding or supporting people who identify in that way, in that situation. So that, I just remember that tension and just feeling for the person, you know, same time, just observing the whole conversation that's occurring in that room.
Oh yeah. thank you for saying that, because I think it hasn't come up so much yet, but I know that it's definitely a real thing, and it was like before there was as much consciousness around that.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh. Are you should we move on to the the county jail, it's called the Philadelphia prison system, but it's like still like the county jail, right? Like it's not, it's like before people are convicted, right? The place that you are at, right?
I'm really not sure. I'm guessing because it was, but we got moved around a couple times. So I feel like we were at one point in a jail, and we were outside in some trailers. Like, they didn't have enough space for all of us. So we were all together at one point in these trailers, and that was really, that's where a lot of beauty came in.
Did you say beauty?
Yeah.
Ah.
Like, we were able to be with each other. We did yoga with each other. Like, somebody was like, let's do some stretches. And I had never done yoga at that point. And so it just felt really good to move our bodies. Like, we'd been, you know, like, just moving that, those aching muscles and hearts, you know, at the same time. That felt really good. I think someone else, people were using song a lot. So people started singing, and we would sing, and that was just so uplifting. Never experienced song in that way. It's really beautiful to sing as a group of people going through something. Just really intense. And so we also got spooked up by the food. Like, we'd be given some beans or something. We thought that it had some maggots in it, but come to find out later, it wasn't. So we were just all, like, super paranoid and scared of everything. Oh, God. But that was just feeling the, like, spirit is really resilient, and just feeling that come through song, like feeling that rejuvenation, is just really powerful. At the same time, going through something like that. So, but then we got transferred, and so we had the suits on, and we were in, like, I think we were in once at one time a maximum security prison. Yeah,
that's what Sandra said too. Yeah. Wow. And then at one point you were with the general population?
Mm-hmm. But then that was crazy. I think I would have preferred to actually have been not with an activist at that point. Because I think that's when conversations about race and I think that's when it got really intense. Like, this one woman, we really struggled with each other. She was white, I'm black, and for the first night, like, she really freaked out, and she actually jumped onto my bed, shaking to death, you know, having to be overnight. And, you know, it was just like, look, we got to be, we can't make it through this, you know? And I think afterwards she was like, oh, you know, I feel like you have so much strength. It reminds me of these pictures that I took of these, you know, black nannies holding the white babies. And I was like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, please stop. You know, I saw that was just driving me up the wall, you know? So I was just saying how I don't think those pictures are beautiful. Like, you think those are pictures of beauty and nurturance. And I feel like when I hear of those pictures, I think of, oh, where was that woman's baby? Who was holding her children? Well, she was holding your children, you know? Like, that you're marveling about. And that was really deep, having that kind of discussion with the person. I had conversations like that. And it was very mind-opening for both of us, having these conversations. And we just struggled through it. We were locked in a cell together. So where were we going? We just had to face each other. And that, I think, was really powerful. Like, there was nowhere to run, nowhere to move. Like, we had to survive this together and have these conversations together and deal with each other. And we did.
Wow. Oh, my God.
Yeah. I just remember that moment, that distinct moment when they closed it. It was just like, okay, this is it. We're going to have to deal with each other. She was from Texas. Just really a powerful person in her own right. And it was just really powerful, though, having to deal with those kind of concepts that we have of each other.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's very difficult. I mean, you're already dealing with so much, and then to have something like that come out of the blue, that's just...
But it was great. I mean, I would not trade that experience at all. Like, I loved how, like, we were in the jail. Like, people were talking about music, and some people had never heard of, like, some of the artists. Like, for example, I think, like, Founder and I were talking about, and we hadn't heard of their punk bands. And so it was just, like, real culture clash, you know? Culture clash between, like, the punks and the people who like hip-hop, and it was just really a clash. It was really interesting. People were not into each other at first. We're not into each other. Like, you're somebody different. Like, some people didn't wear deodorant or wore, like, their hair a certain way, you know? And so some people were had aversion to that, and, you know, it was just really culture clash. I thought it was all really great. Like, I'm like, wow, people just sit on the floor and just, like, you know, are really in resistance to all of these bad standards. And I thought it was cool. Like, it's the first time I met people who done that. So, you know, first time I met people who dye their hair, like, purple or red. And it was just really cool. It was such a culture clash and also encounter. So... I like that, too.
Yeah.
And then, actually, well, once we got into the prison, that's when we were able to connect. And so even though I was in the cell with an activist, like, once we were, like, especially, like, say, we had recreation time, you know, I feel like that's when I really got to connect to the women who were in the Philly prison system. They immediately said, for example, we've gotten more food because you guys are here. Like, usually there's one egg, and today there's two. You know, like, they're trying to make it look better. Like, we want you, where's your pen and paper? We want you guys to tell about our story. Like, there were college programs, and they're getting cut, and we want those, we need those. It's just really interesting. Yeah.
Wow. That's amazing.
And there were some white women who were incarcerated who were from Philly. So it was just interesting, like, how that connection was also, you know, it was all interesting just being there. And I felt very related, you know, like, yeah, it was interesting.
Did you say related?
Yeah, like, I felt really related who were there. Just, like, I could have known them from anywhere, just with the women who were already incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
They braided my hair. Like, it was like one of those kind of experiences, or just like they took me into. Those were the main things that they were telling me.
Yeah.
Just how, for example, in the recreation area when we were playing volleyball with each other, like how important that time was for them, like that time. And then the ball went out of the lines, then they couldn't get it because it would be given more time. I was like, really? Like, you can't go right there and get it? Like, it's right there. It's right past the line. And so just that fear of being given more time and just not wanting to do anything, like, if you don't get a ball that they were permitted to play a game with, you know, it's just astounding to me in terms of the type of control that was present from, for example, the security, corrections officer. And so I got the ball. So I just noticed my privilege in that moment, too. You know, besides the fact that I was going to be leaving, I knew I would be leaving. I didn't know when, but.
Wow, so they would be given more jail time if they
yeah.
got, if, that's insane.
Mm-hmm. That's what a couple women said, and so they would not go get the ball. So I did. You know, one of the people who were there temporarily, and so no one said anything to me when I went and did it, and so they saw that also.
Huh.
That was really hard.
It was hard knowing that you might have some privilege in that area.
Mm-hmm. No, definitely knowing that I did, and like how they were also living and also how they're experiencing that. So, like, all of you guys are going to be leaving. You will be leaving. And we will still be here. And they definitely wanted the message out that, like, why their programs getting cut, like, to go to college or to get their high school diplomas, needing more food, like, those kind of things were the general messages that people said. And they were really happy that we were there. You know, like, for the women who spoke to me, they were happy. Like, instead of it seeming like we were imposing, it's just, like, good. Somebody is looking, noticing. And in that moment, people, like, because the movement had within the jail, and that was also interesting. Like, we were hearing back from people who were able somehow to get in connection with the men and also hear what was happening on their side. Like, they really tried to put fear into the activist women who were to fight, you know, that they would be really violated and, oh, yeah, you want to come into the jail? You wait and see, you know, and I would definitely be interested in hearing all of the details of what happened for the men in the jails, but I heard it was really powerful also for them.
I do have, like, the list, the list of demands from the men, from the general population.
That was so, just hearing about that, hearing what they were able to do also was so inspiring for me. Just, I don't even know how we got that information leaked over to us, but again, like, we had some kind of notes and friends passed to each other. It was great. Really great in terms of how people were just really being creative and rebelling what was being imposed. It was great. And moving beyond fears, like, in a really big way.
Oh, that's amazing. I mean, I remember doing jail support and we got that message from the men. It was written like in little teeny handwriting. And I was like, this is Chris's handwriting. I reckon because I had known him for, you know, we had been close comrades for years. And and I totally started crying. It was amazing just to see those demands, you know, that were so moving. And like, we were in this meeting, like, you know, and they were saying the women were going on water strike and we were all freaking out. And I thought it was everyone, but it was apparently just like two women. And I was like, all my friends are going to die in there, you know. It was just like, holy shit, you know.
You know what, that's how we were able to make communication with each other. This was the legal support. They were just so important. They were the glue. Like, they were able to have, like, we were separate prisons at that point, the men and the women. So being able to have information passed along through the lawyers to the women and from the women to the men, it's like we were able to still be connected. That's how we figured it out. So that's also great.
Mm-hmm. So just to clarify, you were saying like the men, you had heard the men said that they were threatened by like guards that the other men who were locked up would attack them. Is that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Like you're gonna get raped basically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, oh yeah, you guys want to get in here so bad. You want to, you know. think you want to be in jail, you'll see.
Holy shit. Yeah, that stuff is so intense. As an AIDS activist, like, there's so much stigma for men when they come out of jail or prison because, like, there's all this, like, assumption about, you know, what you did inside or whatever, and then, like, there's all this stigma about, like, HIV. Oh, that's a whole other conversation, but...
mm-hmm. No, like, that was huge. And also, there were men, too, who were gender nonconforming as well, and so they were like, yeah, you're going to get raped, like, all, you know, so definitely, like, used to intimidate.
I think, like, some of the lessons are, like, you know, basically... you know, how do we carry ourselves? I think, like, one of the things that you've, like, kind of you've already talked about is, just, like, basically, you know, white anarchists need to, like, educate ourselves about how to be, like, good comrades and all this. But also, like, in the future, you know, it's going to be part of the Slam Herstory Project. So that is going to be, like, I mean, the idea with the Slam Herstory Project is more that it's for young people of color, radicals, like, who identify with SLAM to really, like, learn from SLAM. So any of, like, if there was anything in particular that you would want to share with either of those, like, groups, you know, or, like, types of people, like...
It's to do it. Participate, be in it, and to know that like, it's life-changing, like, what they're doing, their spark, their enthusiasm, their energy, like, it's so important, and it's what's driving everyone forward. Young people, you know, like, I know that they are the raising grannies, who I respect so, they are crazy, they're great. but in general, the young people who are able to, who start off those direct actions, and I think our world is going to need a lot more of it, you know? And I'll be happy to be alongside them, learning from them and what is happening, what's most current. But I think my big message would be just to figure out how to see each other and really hear each other. I feel like we spent so much time doing that, and we felt frustrated by that because we felt like there was something more that had to be done in that moment. Like, we had to make certain decisions, we had to do this, and that's true. But just the fact of being able to see each other and hear each other beyond our judgments, what we thought was different or strange, like, I think all of that needed to happen at the same time. So maybe people could have encounters more with each other, like people who are outside of their immediate affinity groups or organizing circles, to them it'll be easier to make decisions and to take action with each other. Because if there aren't relationships, there's nothing. Like, people are able to organize the way they were able to for this protest because they had affinity groups, they had strong relationships in which trust was present. So I would suggest that people are able to have encounters with other affinity groups or other organizing circles more often before they're able to even do an action with each other so that there can be trust and more experience in deciding things with each other. There's so many different ways to do it. Yeah. Just keep on keeping on. Mm-hmm. As an old principal, a Georgia high school principal of mine, said, before I met SLAM activists, like, what really two things politicized me or just helped me have a critical analysis of the world that I'm living in. One was getting involved in NYPIRG. Like, I was just in chemistry class, and NYPIRG came to my class and said, hey, we're having a campaign about homelessness. Does anyone want to get involved? And I was like, I do. You know, just someone asking me to be involved in something other than my immediate classwork, I think that was so important. And just being allowed, for them being allowed to just go into any random class, I felt like that was really useful. And that was actually my entrance into feeling like I could do something. you know, about conditions that I experience in the world as not being good. And I think that's what, to me, at the core activism is, just knowing that you have the power to do something about what you feel isn't happening well or right or is injustice. And then the second thing, well, the most important thing, actually, the very first thing, when I got into college, I was 17, I thought I knew everything, and I went into my Black and Puerto Rican Studies class on African civilization from ancient times to, like, 1900, and the first thing I learned in that class was that everybody has a worldview, and that there are, that everyone also has a frame of reference for their knowledge. And I was like, really? Like, I've never been told that before. I just couldn't believe that I lived my whole life and went through so many history classes and didn't realize that that was an actual lens that someone had, and that they were presenting as the truth. And so for me, like, that was revolutionary to learn. And so I got to see myself in a new way, you know, through a new historical lens. And so that was through what they call, like, identity politics. And so some people, like, while we were out there, just seemed to look down on that, like, oh, well, that's all about identity politics, and it's all about class, and that's where the struggle really is. But for many people of color, for me as a Black woman, that was huge, to be able to learn about the world in a new way, learn about myself in a new way through how I identify. So I feel like, in terms of encounters, I feel like that's really important, is knowing that people, how people begin understanding and getting an analysis, and often it begins with your own direct experience in the world, and that's valuable and important. So I just wanted to put that in there, because that was definitely a catalyst for me.
Oh, that's amazing. I feel like that's a really great way of talking about, you know, identity politics, you know, like the value of it, because, God, that comes up all the time, I feel like, in the left, like people mm-hmm. will say, like you said, like people will be like, oh, that's identity politics, but there's, like, and they'll just dismiss it, and it's like, no.
And, it's, and but it's often people who, like, say, for example, if it's, like, someone who's white and says, well, that's just identity politics, we need to talk about class, and solely dismissing someone else's entire experience in the world, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's, like, the whole, yeah, like you said, like, it's, like, the whole basis of, like, why are we here? Why are we doing this work? It's because people's experiences are, like, it's unjust, right? Like, people are having experiences that are not, that people shouldn't have to be having. So if you deny
right.
someone's experience, then what's the point anyway?
Right. I didn't realize that, like, I didn't have a language even before that, before I learned even
mm-hmm.
about my own identity. I had no language to use to even understand, oh, that there's a worldview, and the history has been written in a way that is based on white supremacy. Like, oh, really? Didn't know. I didn't even put that together until I was 17. You know, I had to have someone give that to me, like, oh, that. And so then I was able to then analyze and look and question using that frame of reference. So.
Wow.
I feel like I remember that coming up then, too. And that everybody had a different experience. Like, there are people who didn't grow up in primarily Black or Latin neighborhoods who were people of color who had a different interpretation of that also. You know, so being able to have that also, that diversity of experience present. You know, like not everyone has the same ideas about it, even if they, you know, how depending on how they identify.